Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
And I am Simone Tagliapietra.
And today we are discussing about the need for a transatlantic climate alliance, and we are grateful to host Anna Palacio with us. Hi Anna, how are you?
Well, I'm great. I'm in Brussels, by the way, and Brussels is like Seville today. It's hot, beautiful weather, frankly. The difference with Seville is that the leaves are so green that we have to speak about green agenda.
Indeed, indeed. Absolutely. We are all kind of sweating today, I have to say. Anna is an international lawyer specializing in international and European law, and she was the first woman to serve as Foreign Affairs Minister of Spain between 2002 and 2004. She's the former member of the European Parliament, where she chaired the Legal Affairs and the Internal Market, as well as the Citizens' Rights, Justice and Home Affairs Committee. She also served as a member of the Spanish Parliament and as a member of the Council of State of Spain. And at the moment, Anna is a visiting professor at the Walsh School of Foreign Service at the Georgetown University and regular contributor to Project Syndicate, El Mundo and many other outlets around the world. So we are really, really proud to have you with us, Anna. I also want to remind our listeners that this is a live recording session, which is taking place on the Sound of Economics Club on Clubhouse. And as usual for our live recordings, we will have contributions from some of our listeners who have connected with us in the room. So back to the topic. Anna and Simone, you recently wrote together a piece in which you argue that it is high time to forging a transatlantic Green Deal. You have been arguing that stars are particularly aligned for such discussion, as Joe Biden is coming for the first time in Europe as the President of the United States. How can we measure so far such alignment between the two sides of the Atlantic on climate commitments and the climate policy agenda?
First, citizens. And what we know is that the 2021 Transatlantic Trend Survey just proved that citizens on both sides of the Atlantic view climate as the top priority for cooperation between Europe and the United States. Second is the authorities, the government, or the authorities talk. And frankly, we have the talk. In Europe, we have had it for a long time. Europe has kept the flame when the United States was aloof, when the United States first did not really understand the challenge of climate change. The European Union, since the Kyoto Protocol, has been there. Sometimes we were not, I would say, politically savvy, as, for instance, I would not go into details, but for instance, in the Copenhagen Summit in 2009, where we understood that we would make our commitments and the world would follow, and the world did not follow. And frankly, we have kept the flame, and we had the alignment with the Obama administration, and with the leadership of the United States there, we have to say we wanted a legally binding. It was not legally binding, but we got the Paris Accord. And then we went into the terrible years of Trump. And now we have a new administration, and Biden has talked the talk and has proven and has asked. And I have taken just one figure, because I don't like figures, but I know that Bruegel likes figures, so I will give you. In the budget request, the White House has requested nearly a 40% increase to 45 million for the Bureau for Ocean Energy Management for offshore wind project, which it's symbolic, but this is the talk. We have the big reconstruction fund of almost 2 billion, and there is a lot there. Now we need that the United States walk the walk. And I finish where I started, is that the perception is in Europe, there is a, we have been overwhelmed, and there was, we celebrated that Biden won the elections, but we don't really fully trust the United States. Everybody, I would say there is a, not everybody, but there is a generalized understanding that what if in 2024 United States goes to a Trumpian approach, what we would do? So in investing in this relationship, we really need that the administration, that Biden, and it will be important that besides talking the talk, the United States walks the walk. And this, of course, it's not just by the administration, it's also the Congress. And we hope that there is a federal approach, because there are states, Washington, California, New York, that are really aligned with the European Union. But now we need a commitment at the federal level, because the United States has a convening power that European Union we don't have. And we need to bring other allies and other like-minded to this big challenge. I mean, I would say that it's an existential challenge. And I'm paraphrasing or quoting Biden, but we know in Europe, we know that we have known it for many years. For many years, we have felt alone. And now we have an administration that goes beyond, doubles the ambitions of Obama. So let's walk together.
Thank you, Anna. I'm having a follow-up question to this, zooming in a little bit in the, let's say, the internal situation in the United States, and zooming in our own situation at the European Union level. To fulfill those commitments, you know, because there has been also on the side of the EU, you know, the Green Deal and the climate targets and so on. So to fulfill these commitments on both sides, what kind of challenges the EU and the US at their internal level will have to overcome, which is the actual baseline? Perhaps Simone can enlighten us on this.
Yeah, thank you, Giuseppe, and thank you, Anna, because you really provided, I think, a great overview of what is on the table right now. I appreciated, Anna, your point to lock in climate action in the United States over the next years, because we don't know which kind of president we might have after Biden. So I think there is a clear recognition on both sides of the Atlantic, if you talk in green circles, that the next years are really important, and it is really important to take measures that cannot easily be reversed should a new president enter the White House right after the first mandate of Biden. Now, Giuseppe, to coming to your question, so what are the common challenges that the EU and the US face while walking in the decarbonization trajectory? I think the two blocks are basically confronting a very similar set of challenges. First of all, it is clear that both need to substantially scale up the deployment of renewable energy technologies, electric vehicles, electricity storage technologies, and foster innovation in emerging technologies that will be needed to get to climate neutrality. And there I think about green hydrogen, I think about new generation of batteries, and also the enabling digital technologies that we need, for example, in smart grids. Here, of course, the big issue is whether the US and the EU are competitors or can cooperate in this technological field. I think that, of course, the realpolitik here is that there will be competition for market share, etc., in existing technologies. Think about electric vehicles, think about wind turbines or solar panels. But there might be ample scope for cooperation on those technologies that we still have to properly develop. And I think at green hydrogen here. So the US and EU might cooperate on technological innovation, also because, let's say, in the world there is another player that we know very well, China, that is going fast in this field. The second challenge that the EU and the US need to tackle is certainly the one of making a better use of carbon pricing. Here, I think the EU is clearly more advanced than the United States, because Europe has the largest carbon market in the world. The ETS is now trying to expand this carbon market to other sectors. And in July, we will see a proposal from the Commission on this. As we know, the United States has a difficult relationship with carbon pricing. As Anna mentioned, certain states within the US are advanced, think of California and its own ETS, but at the federal level, we do not have today a carbon pricing system in the United States. And this is a big challenge. The president is not really vocal on that front, but in Congress, both in the Senate and in the House of Representatives, there are two bills, carbon pricing bills nowadays, under discussion, and both involve the creation of a carbon market plus the introduction of carbon border adjustment measures. Third, and then I conclude, I think the other challenge that both the EU and the US are facing is the one of addressing the socioeconomic implications of the green transition. Now, it is increasingly visible that if a country is serious on decarbonization, then people will feel the economic cost. If you introduce carbon pricing in transport, the price of the gasoline at the pump will rise. The question is, this might affect and will affect the poorer more than the richer. And therefore, given these distributional implications, there is a need to ensure, let's say, a social climate safety net. There is a need to take care of this dimension to ensure the social equality of the green transformation. And here, there are really common challenges in the two blocks, which could also potentially be sorted out together. And I think notably at the concept of carbon dividends that, as you might remember, was at the center of a manifesto that more than 3,500 US economists signed 2 years ago, among whom a number of Nobel Prize laureates and also Janet Yellen. And then after some months later, also European economists came up with a similar manifesto. So the concept of carbon dividends, so using the revenues of carbon pricing to compensate the poorer, I think it's very important in this framework, alongside the just transition dimension, which is really targeted to the industries that will have to go, like coal, etc., and should be targeted and leaving no one behind, which is an issue very important in both Europe and the United States.
Anna, do you have something to add to what Simone said?
Yeah, I fully agree. And just to add, I think that we Europeans, we are really a regulatory power. And this carbon pricing is one of the very good examples. I'm not sure that we will manage. We have written, because I fully agree with Simone, this is fundamental, but we may get a different way in the United States, through targeted decisions. We are very good at regulation. The federal and the system in the United States is much more complicated. First thing. Second thing, the same way that I say where we are strong, we are too ideological. We need to bring some common sense. We cannot just put some technologies out and just don't count on them, because we have to be clear what is the target here. If the target is greenhouse emissions, if the target is decarbonization, then let's think about nuclear. Let's at least think. Don't be ideological about that. Or just let's think about carbon capture, sequestration, and utilization. This was very high in our agenda, European agenda, in the 2000s, but it has disappeared. Why? Because gas was then a transition, a long transition element, and today gas is a no-no. We have to be, and there the Americans are much more, I would say, practical, realistic. Well, let's see what works. And the truth is that the Americans have reduced their carbon footprint in a much faster way than we have, and especially the way that some member states like Germany has after taking the political decision of nuclear. And I say, let's discuss, let's not be ideological. My last comment. I think that we have to see that we are complementary. We are competing, frankly, not in solar panels, because the solar panels are Chinese. They are not American and they are not ours. And unfortunately, today, most of the hydro generators, the green hydro generators, are Chinese. I think that we need to put together in research, investing in research, and understanding that we need a strong industry to make our economies green. So this would be my complementary remarks to what Simone has said, and that I fully agree with.
Thank you, Anna. And those complementary remarks are definitely food for thought and debate, because, of course, they are also touching some provocative points. When you mentioned the nuclear, definitely we could have a long discussion, which I'm not going to open in this frame, but it's definitely something that would be worth to debate, as you mentioned. I would like to move a little bit forward from those challenges, because we all know that without a global impact, I mean, you started to mention China, you started to mention, so there are these challenges within the EU and the EU debate and the member states, the challenges with the US in order to move forward, but then changes in only one or two parts of the world will not be enough. That we are pretty sure about that, especially when we speak about climate change. How can a joint cooperation, so this transatlantic climate alliance that you are envisaging between the EU and the United States, could leverage the rest of the world?
I think that when we really mean it together, then we achieve a global agreement. And the example is Paris. Paris was European initiative. It became realistic when Ernst Moniz took it and the Obama administration took it. And in the end, it was not easy. It was not what we, regulatory power, wanted, legally binding, but it's what was achievable, what was realistic. And there we had even India. Remember how complicated it was. And China and everybody. So, again, I think that now, in both sides of the Atlantic, we are a bit, we Europeans, we don't, how could I put it? We have to be more self-assured. When we are together, we can achieve things. It's not true we feel overwhelmed by this rise of China, by this shrinking of the open society, of our principles, of our ways of addressing things. But frankly, when we are together, and this is why it's so important, because again, the convening power, we don't have it. We have many qualities, and as I say, in this area it has been proven. But with the United States, we can start getting. I mean, G7 is a very good example, and beyond G7, the like-minded, and then the interested, and then establish, if necessary and where necessary, a very even tough dialogue with others to achieve it. And I think we can do it. We have to be realistic. We have to bet on our resources. We have to bet on our industry. We have to be competitive in the world. But frankly, we have for us that climate change is an existential threat perceived from the Maldives to Alaska. I mean, everywhere, from the Inuits to the Hawaiians, everybody, the citizens perceive it. as a systemic threat. And in many societies, it's through the citizens that this has gone to the authorities. China, frankly, is an example where the quality of air, the very concrete concerns of the citizens have made the needle move. So I'm heartened. I think that we can a lot, that we have to be more self-confident, and that this is why this transatlantic, it's not everything, but it's an alliance that will be front runner and that will have other allies, and then we'll reach agreements. Not the ideal ones, the realistic ones.
Thank you, Anna. Simone, would you like to add something on this global perspective of this alliance?
Yeah, thank you, Giuseppe. And what I would like to add is that in international relations in general, and also in these climate issues in particular, size matters. The US and Europe combined represent 40% of the global economy and 30% of international goods imports. Now, what happens here matters also in the rest of the world. So if the US and Europe are to introduce jointly certain kind of environmental standards, then many countries out there, starting with China, will need to comply if they want to sell their products to the United States and Europe. Likewise, if the US and Europe adopt a similar taxonomy on sustainable finance, that has the potential to shape the international finance in this field. The most notable example that is nowadays attracting a lot of interest is, of course, the issue of carbon border adjustment, right? So imagine if the US and Europe are to introduce, let's say, through a so-called climate club, jointly carbon border adjustment, that would possibly be a great leverage for other countries to accelerate their decarbonization efforts, as they would prefer to introduce carbon pricing domestically and keep the revenues of this carbon pricing domestically rather than basically giving such revenues to the Europeans or to the Americans. So I think the market dimension is very important here, and this is one of the most important tools that the Transatlantic Climate Alliance could exercise to really boost decarbonization globally. The other topic, which is of course at the table of the G7 as we speak, is the one of climate finance, is the one of really stepping up to the Paris Agreement commitment taken by developing nations, namely European countries and the US, to provide financial support for developing countries in pursuing their green transitions. And here I think we need to be more creative than in the past and really think that climate finance at the end of the day is also industrial policy for Europe and the United States, because it means supporting also our companies, utilities or clean tech companies, to enter strongly rising markets. And therefore, this is something that meets at the same time our climate objectives and our industrial competitiveness objectives.
Allow me one sentence. Yeah, but let's again be realistic, because you have mentioned the taxonomy. And what we have seen in the taxonomy is that after long debates, we have excluded nuclear like that. We are absolutely ambivalent in clean technologies based on gas. Well, you know, I think that this is a debate that has to be addressed both sides of the Atlantic, because there are realities there. Gas is there. Nuclear is there in the world. And frankly, we Europeans, we have to understand that our ideology, I mean, I'm happy that Germany decides or France does not decide. That's a different thing. But as a projection for the world, if we want to have an impact, let's just be more common sense, more pragmatic in this as the Americans. On the rest, again, I fully agree. The carbon border adjustment, which is something that has to be used carefully, because if not, in my opinion, we could create these adjustments, structural disadjustment, but it's a very good tool that we would need, because of the size, that is absolutely clear, we would need to address together.
Thank you, Anna. I would have one additional question to both of you, but I would like to give the floor to Amer, who joined from the audience, and I would kindly ask to present yourself, Amer, and please give your thoughts or questions to Simone and Anna.
First of all, thank you, Anna, thank you, Simone, Giuseppe, and Bruegel, as always. My name is Amer Hussein. I'm a Syrian economy expert and a researcher, and of course, climate is at the forefront of that. And part of my research is also the interaction between security and climate, especially with focus on the MENA region. The reason why I've always enjoyed these discussions that Bruegel organizes is because there's always seems to be a kind of an agenda, an actionable insights that come out on the back of this, and the stuff that Anna and Simone said are fantastic in, you know, the what are the pillars for creating that sort of a global agreement. But then now, acting as the devil advocate and in a kind of a question way, you know, Anna, you've just talked about the common sense that will unify us to take an action against this. And I have seen, you know, when I've seen the G7 communique come out on the weekend and said that an agreement on tax has been reached, I said, fantastic, finally multilateralism is back, cooperation is back, etc. But then 2 days later, I started reading that Rishi Sunak was trying to exclude the city of London from the agreement. Somebody else was trying to exclude another industry in their country, which they thought could also be affected by such tax rate. The same situation of kind of everybody searching for an exceptionalism has been seen also with John Kerry's discussions with the Europeans. So, question for the floor. What do we think is that common sense that we can present to leaders so they can just understand that this is a plan for all and everybody should follow it if we want to keep the planet that we live in and keep the economy and our social well-being, etc.
Thank you, Amer, for this provocative but very relevant question. Anna Simone, who wants to give a try?
Ahmed, thank you for this question. It was not pre-cooked, honestly, but it's a great question because I think that this is the crux of the matter. In the world, we are not alone. We have to be, again, realistic. And how to do that is to study the circumstances that are out there and to see that we cannot go. It will be, not that we cannot go, it's that it will be less efficient to go with our maximalist positions. I'm going to refer to an anecdote of an article published by The Economist 2 or 3 weeks ago. It was about gas canisters for cooking in sub-Saharan Africa. And of course, our approach, Europeans, is that sub-Saharians have to go from burning the woods to a power vitroceramic, I don't know how you say this in English, but one of these things that you cook with electricity that are what we have at home, with power by renewable energy. And okay, what is The Economist, and The Economist, we all know where The Economist is, but what it was is saying, well, okay, there is no financing, there is no NGO that provides this, which means that the Africans in this area are still cooking with wood. Wouldn't it be better to finance as a transition these canisters and just wait until they have this polished surfaces powered by electricity with electric power. This is one tiny example of what I mean by common sense. And I think that, Ahmed, you could contribute. Bruggen is a fantastic place. With Simone, you have an agenda now to have a survey of, speak with people, see what, and with this common idea that what we have in common is decarbonization, is to lower the levels of greenhouse emissions, to see how we go about that, not just in our rich societies, but in the world, in different areas, and reach a common launch, a common effort that takes all this into account. And I would end by saying that Simone has touched upon one thing that I'm sorry, but I think that we don't have right, which is the cost of this transition, the cost in jobs, in livelihoods, in our own societies, but in many other jurisdictions. We need to factor in all this.
Yeah, absolutely. And Anna, I think factoring in, this is the real challenge, because so far, climate action has been niche. It was up to climate scientists, to very specific policy makers or climate economists, etc. This issue is becoming mainstream only now, while we start to recognize, all of us, the broad nature of this revolution, industrial revolution for real. So this social dimension of the transition is completely missing. I think Ursula von der Leyen talked for the first time about this issue of the distributional effects of the carbon market, etc., 2 weeks ago. Timmermans only spoke yesterday about an initial idea of setting up a social fund for the transition to redistribute the revenues of the ETS to low-income families. So this is really something that we are only starting, and since we are all only starting now to understand and reflect on these issues, I think there might be also the case for a transatlantic joint dialogue here. But what I wanted to say, reacting to Amer's point on what we have seen coming out of the G7 during the weekend, I wanted to say that my first reaction was, imagine if in, 5 or more years, we were to see countries agreeing on a minimum carbon price. I mean, this decision we have seen in the weekend, with all the difficulties that we will see, of course, coming out of different countries, but it was an historical decision that was considered almost impossible for a long time, and now we got there. And my hope is that the G7, the G20, and the leading economies at a certain point will recognize that since time is running out in climate action, we might even get finally to a minimum carbon price that would really be important to drive investments in the right direction globally. And this is something that has always been and continues to be impossible to think. But I think that in this space, we will also, over time, see dramatic changes in policy making. I mean, if you think about the speed of this transition, also from a policy perspective, the European Green Deal was launched in December 2019, so it is less than 2 years that we are really seeing an impressive wave of similar initiatives all around the world, and the climate neutrality pledges, etc. So the speed of this is breathtaking, and I think we can really expect major changes also from these political perspectives in the future as well. Of course, in a way that is sustainable and affordable to all, because otherwise we will have a backlash, not only in our own society from the poorest, but also from developing countries at the global level.
Thank you, Simone and Anna, of course. Let me perhaps add a final question, which is also a devil's advocate question. Don't you think that there is much more enthusiasm for transatlantic cooperation in the European Union? There is somehow the feeling that the agenda that has been set in Brussels in the past 4 years, during the Trump years, could be inspirational in the States now that there is a change of guard over there. Don't you think that perhaps this is overemphasized in this part of the Atlantic and that the actual real interest and intentions shown so far from the USA foreign policy maybe goes definitely in the direction of the things that we say, like fight climate change, bring back the US in the global international community and so on. But how much appetite there is to an actual strong and equally on an equal footing cooperation between the EU and the States in that specific historical moment?
As a final thought, I think that yes, there is an opportunity, and the opportunity is clear. Why? Frankly, because in general terms, the United States has realized that the hegemony of the past is not any longer possible, that now there is a system that has nothing to do with the multilateral rules-based system that was established by the United States, with the Europeans, with Latin Americans. Remember that in those days after World War II, there were a lot of countries that were still colonies. So, but that today that we are not there, that this overwhelming hegemony of the United States is gone, that the world is different, and therefore that we need a leadership of the United States, but that it is a leadership that will bring together allies. They need us. For the first time, they really need us. This has the other side of the coin, is that we cannot take anything for granted, of course, but that the United States will not take us for granted either. I think there is an awareness that the world has changed and that in this new world, with a competing system by China that has an expansive projection, well, the United States cannot go alone and has to count on allies. So I think that there is a possibility. Now, on our side, we Europeans, we have this missionary zeal. We go with our ideology, and I think that frankly we have to understand the position of the United States, that is looking inwards. This is the priority of this administration, is to make, if I may paraphrase, they told us that they wanted a Europe whole, free, and at peace. We want a United States healed, united, and looking into the world with this convening leadership that the world needs today. At least our open society oriented world, because there is a competing vision of the world that is there and that is doing great. And we need to demonstrate, this is my call to realism and to common sense, is that we need to demonstrate that our approach works and works for everybody and has advantages, clear advantages, also in areas where today we look at vaccines and say, oh, China has done it great. Okay, yeah, we have as well. And we need to be able to claim this approach. So I'm very heartened. I think that the Americans have finally realized that the world has changed and that they need us and others, not just us, but all the like-minded that see a world with an open society, rules-based, multilateral approach.
Simone, your last thoughts.
Yeah, I really agree with what Anna said, and I really think that There is and there are clear complementarities and affinities among the US and EU, not only on climate, but on many other issues. And there is really a potential for strong cooperation to really provide a global contribution to issues that are existential for the world. Now, is Europe more committed than the US in this relationship? Honestly, Giuseppe, it might well be the case. It might well be that the US has a number of different strategic priorities, and Europe might not necessarily be considered as the primary partner here. But in my view, history is there to remember that if we are together, we are way better off. And that the transatlantic cooperation can really be transformative under so many standpoints. Now, what should Europe do? I think this is the question. No? What should Europe do if the US at a certain point is not there in this cooperation to the level we hope it will be? Well, in my view, Europe should move forward with its own initiatives in any case, with or without the United States, possibly with the United States. And Europe needs to try as much as possible to engage and have a constructive dialogue. But if in climate, from carbon pricing to carbon border adjustment, taxonomy, etc., there is no willingness to develop this instrument jointly, then Europe should pursue its plans and go ahead. Because, as Anna said, I think we should not be shy. We should also have a consideration of our, I will not say our power, but certainly our soft power, and also our role in the global economy. I mean, we are a large market. We are a large economy. Standing together, we have, I think, a set of values that are really oriented at also global public goods. And I also like, I always like to remember that Europe, for example, is the first provider of official development assistance in the world. So our commitment to developing nations is strong. And think about what has been the approach of Europe in the vaccines and in the provision of vaccines to developing countries of the last months, right? So I think Europe has all the characteristics and the possibility to stand up and have that so-called geopolitical stance that the Commission claims it wants to build. And I think this is something that we can achieve. But trying to corroborate our position with the US and work jointly on these important issues, I think it's the necessary first step. But then if we don't get what we are expecting in terms of cooperation, we should certainly keep on going, because I think we have clear ideas on where we want to arrive, and we should try to get there.
Thank you to both of you. And of course, we could keep speaking for quite a long time about this topic, and of course this topic will lead us to many other things. You mentioned vaccines and tax regulation was mentioned, and there are so many things that will be connected then afterwards. So and these are the things that we usually discuss continue to discuss in our Sound of Economic podcast, as well here on Clubhouse. So I would like to thank for tuning in to the Sound of Economics, and I would like to remind everyone that the piece written by Simone and Anna is available on our website www.bruegel.org, together with all the analysis by our scholars, which are completely accessible in open access. So thank you so much, Simone. Thank you so much, Anna. And to all our listeners, Amer, to join us on the floor of our Clubhouse room. Thanks for joining the Sound of Economics. And until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.